That is the sound you never want to hear. It is the sound of a warning siren going off at a nuclear power plant. But whether you can hear that sound or not, we are all in the nuclear hot seat. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly podcast keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevy. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island. This week is a hot one for the San Onofre Nuclear Power Plant in Southern California. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is holding an open meeting on Friday in Dana Point, where Southern California Edison will be presenting its restart plans for Unit 2. We'll check in with four activists about the importance of this week's actions, what our side is doing, and how you can participate. That will be coming up in a few minutes. Today is Tuesday, November 27, 2012, and here is the week's nuclear news. A United Nations rights investigator said on Monday that Japan hasn't done enough to protect the health of residents and workers affected by the Fukushima nuclear accident. Anand Grover, UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, said the government has adopted overly optimistic views of radiation risks and has conducted only limited health checks after the partial meltdowns at several reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Although he welcomed ongoing health checks of affected residents, Grover said they were too narrow in scope because they were only intended to cover Fukushima's 2 million people and that only children were being given thyroid tests, even though the impact of radiation went far beyond Fukushima's borders. He said the health survey should cover all radiation-affected zones, stretching across much of the northeastern half of the main Japanese island of Honshu. So far, only one quarter of Fukushima's population has been covered. Special Rapporteur Grover also said that it was regrettable that the public was not informed of the radiation plume forecast, that the survey only checks thyroid, which is unfortunately a narrow gauge, that it only uses data from Chernobyl, which is dated and ignores studies that point to cancer and other diseases, that he was concerned about parents being denied the right to access their children's medical documentation and the need to go through cumbersome Freedom of Information Act procedures to get them. He also said that the government should urgently strengthen the enforcement of food safety. In a related story from an alternate universe, the World Health Organization forecast no significant increase in cancer in Fukushima. The report said that cases of cancer caused by radiation from the Fukushima nuclear accident will not increase significantly. Again, the nuclear industry's favorite words, one of them, significantly. The report also said that the chances of young people exposed to low-level radiation developing benign tumors or cysts would likely rise, even though the tumors and cysts are unlikely to become cancerous. This according to the report that came from the World Health Organization. Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds.com and Fairwinds Education said of the report from WHO, "I don't trust this data. My guess is that WHO underestimated the radiological deposition and releases and thus came up with exposures that are too low. Also, I suspect they have omitted hot particles and internal emitters from their dose assumptions. The same thing happened at Three Mile Island. Bad assumptions create low exposures. Garbage in, garbage out." A video of UN Special Rapporteur Anand Grover's report is available on nuclearhotseat.com/blog. This report comes from our friend Iori Mochizuki from Fukushima Diary. He writes, "The biggest threat at the Fukushima plant is believed to be the spent fuel pool of Reactor 4. They say the pool is set in the really unstable situation. It might not be able to stand after another aftershock. However, other problems include the lack of nuclear workers, the deterioration of the equipment, and storage of contaminated water. From the research of Fukushima Diary, more than 89% of the contaminated water tank is already full. The newly extended tank will be full by 2016. Decommissioning Fukushima is told to take up to 40 years. However, contaminated water storage tanks will be full in the first 5 years, which raises the question, for the other 35 years, what are they going to do?
They must find new places for water storage, but because land is limited and ground is weak, it's becoming harder and harder to find a space. Also, the further away they put the tanks from the reactors, the more likely the pipe gets damaged because it is too long. Some people question the seismic stability of the tanks as well. Moving around the world to the United Kingdom, on Friday, November 23rd, 10 protesters blockaded access to EDF Energy's nuclear sites at Hinkley Point in the United Kingdom, preventing the morning shift from starting work. Four people in arm locks formed a barrier across the main road in a bid to prevent further ground clearance work at the planned Hinkley C site and to protest the EDF's plan to extend the life of aging reactors at the Hinkley B station. Local activist Zoe Smith said, EDF still doesn't have planning permission for the new nuclear plant. There is not even enough investment to finish the project. Bridgewater mother Nikki Clark from Southwest Against Nuclear said, not only do they not need new nuclear, we simply don't need to extend the life of the existing reactors even further. Just this year alone, reactor number 4 in the B station has scrammed at least 3 times. EDF likes to call these emergency shutdowns unplanned outages, but this deliberately conceals the fact that these aging reactors are now in dangerous condition. In 2008, regulators threatened British Energy with closure of the site. The reactors do not have any fewer cracks in the graphite core now than they did then. Are we to have our own Fukushima here in Somerset before we abandon this insanity and embrace a renewables revolution in the United Kingdom? A question we all need to be asking ourselves whenever there is a nuclear power plant anywhere nearby. South Korean nuclear regulators have found microscopic cracks in tunnels that guide control rods at a nuclear plant under maintenance, government officials said, raising new concerns over the country's nuclear power sector. The discovery of the cracks at the reactor comes just days after two reactors at the same plant in Yongguan County in the southwest part of the country were shut down to replace parts that had been provided with forged certificates. A spokeswoman for the Presidential Korea Nuclear Safety and Security Commission said it was the first time cracks of this type had been found in South Korea's nuclear sector, but added the safety risk was not serious enough to require public disclosure. According to CNN, Jae Moon-sung, a professor at the Nuclear Engineering Department of Hanyang University, said, the cracks themselves are not a serious issue and have been found at reactors in such other countries as the United States and Japan. Is that cold comfort or what? But Jae warned that the news could hurt South Korea's efforts to export its nuclear power technology to other countries. You think? Back in the United States, the Illinois Emergency Management Agency announced that potassium iodine pills will be available for residents of more than 60,000 homes near the Quad Cities nuclear plant near Cordova, Illinois. Vouchers for the pills will be distributed in the mail by mid-December. Potassium iodide protects the thyroid gland from the effects of radioactive iodine, which could be released in the event of a nuclear accident. It does, however, have no protective effect on any other form of radioactive contamination. Illinois has nuclear plants in addition to Quad Cities near Braidwood, Byron, Clinton, Dresden, and LaSalle. There is no word if residents of those plants will be receiving vouchers for their potassium iodine pills as well. And if not, that raises the question, why are they doing this near Quad Cities? Time to mark your calendars. The medical and ecological consequences of Fukushima, a 2-day symposium, will be held at the New York Academy of Medicine on March 11 and March 12, 2013, to coincide with the second anniversary of the nuclear meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi reactors. The seminar, a project of the Helen Caldicott Foundation, will feature scientists, physicians, engineers, political leaders, and policymakers presenting and discussing preliminary data thus far amassed on the biomedical and ecological consequences of the disaster, both for Japan and, potentially, the rest of the world. In the year and a half since the disaster, according to this report, information has slowly emerged about the health and environmental effects, from increased incidences of thyroid abnormalities in Japanese children, to deformities in the insect, bird, and butterfly populations around Fukushima, to increased levels of cesium present in tuna caught off the coast of California. It is clear that much research by the world's scientists still needs to be done, work which will take years, if not decades, to complete, as the effects of radiation exposure on human, as well as flora and fauna populations, make themselves manifest. It is equally clear that an open forum such as this symposium will play an influential role in pointing the way forward in the evaluation of both the immediate and the ongoing effects of the meltdown. Helen, from your mouth to somebody's ears. So book your airplane tickets now, March 11th and 12th in New York. This report from Reuters, Edison Mission Energy said on November 15th that it missed a $97 million interest payment on its unsecured bonds and could file for bankruptcy as soon as next month. Edison Mission, the unregulated power generation business of Edison International, made the announcement in a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The interest payment deadline carries a grace period that expires on December 17th. Isn't it nice that they get grace periods even if the rest of us don't? No word on how or whether the difficulties of Edison Mission Energy will impact Southern California Edison's situation with San Onofre. Which brings us to the week's featured story. This Friday, November 30th, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will hold an open public meeting in Southern California. This is where Southern California Edison will present its plans for a restart of San Onofre Unit 2 at partial power. The facility has been offline for nearly 10 months, and SCE is pulling out all the stops to ram that restart down our throats. To get a picture of the situation, what our activists are doing, and how you can participate, I interviewed several people directly involved in our activist response. First, I spoke with Myla Reason, a longtime political activist and community organizer whose recent anti-nuclear work has been as a video activist. Myla has been covering all facets of the nuclear battle with her trusty iPhone recorder and posting her results on YouTube for all to see and hear. She gave us a concise overview of the current problems with San Onofre and what we're facing leading up to this hearing on the 30th.
Could you give us just a vision of where we are in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's process of considering whether or not to restart the plant?
SCE and Edison hope to restart the plant, and they are getting all of their regulatory ducks in a row, so to speak, in order to at least create the appearance of having done due diligence and addressing safety concerns. Of course, I think that safety is not a word that should be attached to anything nuclear. I think it's a bit more dangerous than safe, but that's a side issue. There was a release of radioactive hydrogen in January, and that caused the shutdown of the plant. And after that, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission sent out an inspection team. The inspection team met with Edison, found amazing degradation, unprecedented degradation of tubes that had not occurred in any other plant in the country. At the end of that process, they held a public meeting in San Juan Capistrano, I believe that was back in June, and gave their inspection team exit report. And that was a public meeting, not a hearing.
What is the difference between the two?
It has to do with sworn testimony, pretty much. Here at a hearing, especially an adjudicatory hearing, which many of us are calling for and believe is required, people would be sworn in, and they would be subject to perjury laws should they give false witness. The difference is really has to do with formality. A hearing is a formal process, usually before a judge. Witnesses are sworn in. They can be cross-examined, usually by members of the public. At a public meeting, it's just a very informal process where people can pretty much get away with saying anything and not being held accountable for misleading the public.
So going back to last June, you're saying that was a public meeting and not a hearing?
Right. Now we're about to have our third public meeting on the steam generator failures. And so NRC and Edison are giving this appearance of having this very open and transparent process, but they're really trying to convince people that they've done due diligence and that a adjudicatory evidentiary hearing is not necessary, and of course it is necessary.
So where are we now as regards the NRC, Southern California Edison, and the activist response?
Back in October, Edison sent the NRC a letter asking for permission to restart. And they said at that time that if they plugged some of the tubes and ran at 70% as opposed to 100% power, that they could comfortably claim that there will be no more failed tubes and bursts of coolant into the atmosphere and a possible meltdown as a result of the burst tubes. So they're asking for permission to plug the tubes. And at this meeting, this coming Friday, the NRC could in fact give permission to SCE to go ahead and restart, but that probably won't happen. And I believe that it won't happen in part because of all of the community organizing and the spotlight that is now on San Onofre and Southern California Edison. If it were not for that scrutiny and that public spotlight, I think that it's really likely that the permission to restart would happen. There was a legal action brought by the Friends of the Earth calling for an evidentiary adjudicated hearing. And the NRC was forced to either grant that hearing, which they didn't really want to do, so they just kicked the can down the road by directing the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, which is under the NRC, to evaluate and make a determination whether or not that evidentiary adjudicated hearing is called for. So it's unlikely that the NRC will give permission to SCE to restart prior to a determination from that licensing board. So I think that a combination of the activism or the effort by the Friends of the Earth to force an adjudicated evidentiary hearing and the public spotlight all contribute to a delay in the NRC granting the permit. Also, they're really trying not to appear to be the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission. But I think that eventually they will feel that they have created the illusion and done enough PR that they can go ahead and grant restart. But I don't think that that's going to happen this Friday. And I've learned that the new chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Allison McFarlane, is planning a trip to Southern California sometime in January. So it may be at that time that permission is granted or not granted to restart San Onofre.
And is that decision with the commissioners, or does it trickle down to Elmo Collins?
Ultimately, the five commissioners have the decision lies in the hands of the five commissioners of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The five commissioners can even trump the decision of the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board as to whether or not to hold the adjudicatory evidentiary hearing.
Myla brought up the key issue that underlies the entire argument by Southern California Edison for restarting the damaged San Onofre nuclear reactor.
I want to talk about the competing interests between safety and profit. Until this past January, investing in Edison proved to be an extremely profitable for the company's shareholders. But since the shutdown this past January, the value of Edison's stock has been falling. And it seems that Edison is really intent on restarting to stop the hemorrhaging of those profits. They've had to spend a lot of money on replacement energy for their customers. And they haven't enjoyed all of the profits, something like $1 million a day generated by running those nuclear power plants.
So, and aren't they going to be on the hook, according to the California Public Utilities Commission, for the end user refunds for the time that we paid for San Onofre, but it wasn't generating?
You know, that well may be, and in large part because of the work of Rochelle Becker's Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, Edison's shareholders rather than ratepayers may have to pay a large part of the financial price for the colossal failures of Edison's replacement steam generator failures.
At the exact same time this podcast is being edited, on Tuesday, November 27, Gary Hedrick of San Clemente Green is leading his group to offer some contrary information to tonight's PR spin cycle brought to you by Southern California Edison. Specifically, Gary and other concerned citizens will participate in an open house SCE is holding to continue their mission of duping the good people of San Clemente into believing they really do need a leaking, aging, dangerous nuclear reactor creating plutonium waste and leaking radiation into their immediate environment. Here, Gary talks about the week's actions and specifically what he'll be doing tonight.
This week is an exciting week for us in terms of momentum and things coming to a head because Tuesday night, Edison is imposing their will on San Clemente at an open house, and we're going to be there to counteract their efforts to persuade our community that it's safe to restart.
What does their open house look like? Are there booths? Are there speakers? Is there public input? How is that organized?
Well, I went to an Edison event in Vista recently, and they've upgraded their presentation dramatically. There's 3D models of the tubes from the steam generators, and it shows the cables that go through them and the monitoring device, the probe that they sent up to measure the thickness of the tubes. All that stuff is new information that they've put a lot of energy and effort and money into presentation that leaves the unsuspecting average citizen thinking that, hey, wow, these guys really know what they're doing. And that's so dangerous, and we're certainly not going to let that pass in San Clemente, in the heart of the town where we have so much to lose. It's just unacceptable to allow them to come in here and get away with that.
It sounds like they're playing a cross between Disneyland and Mr. Wizard to say, ooh, look at the neat scientific stuff we do, where really what they're not talking about is the dangers. They're just trying to cover it up.
Yeah, it's really obscene almost to think of the way they handpick the facts, and they only want to compare, you know, tube to tube connections where the wear is coming from, the tubes rubbing against each other, and those numbers are radically different than considering all of the worn areas from the anti-vibration supports and different ways that there can be damage to these tubes. They just handpicked one statistic that makes it look like it's safe to restart two, and even though Unit 3, they admit, is not going to be online probably forever. They're so similar in the amount of damage, and they use the information in a very deceptive way.
What is it that the people from San Clemente Green and the other groups are involved in this as well, San Onofre Safety and Residents Organized for a Safe Environment?
Yeah, we all have different ways of working together. This one, because it's in the heart of San Clemente, is more directly involved with San Clemente Green. But we're all in this together, and we'll be there to greet people at the entry and hope they take our information with them and give them some questions that they should ask when they go in and see the exhibits. And then we'll spend some time inside next to the exhibits. Not in any confrontational way, but just as a matter of fact, here's another point of view, and we think these are things that the average citizen needs to know and not just hear one side of it. That'll be interesting. I've never done that with them. They try to control that environment a lot. Right? You know, they wouldn't let us bring posters in. They really can't stop us, I don't think, from bringing in flyers, but we'll see. All we really want to do, though, is share information with people, and if they try to stop us, then that's when it might get a little testy.
On Friday, four Buddhist monks will lead a walk to San Onofre and commence a six-day fast and prayer cycle to commemorate the days leading up to the Buddha's enlightenment. Gene Stone of Residents Organized for a Safe Environment has been involved in facilitating the monks' arrival in Southern California.
How did Residents Organized for a Safe Environment become involved with helping bring the Buddhist monks here for the event on Friday?
The Buddhist monks called and told me that they had picked San Onofre as the spot that they thought needed prayer.
Isn't it true that they do this every year at about the same time on a different issue, and they specifically thought that the nuclear issue, as represented in San Onofre, was the most important and the most needy of prayer at this time?
Yeah, we had a long conversation so that they could explain to me their past, and they have a history of fasting between December the 1st through December the 7th, and every year they pick a place to go walk to that they think is imperative for their type of prayer and political action, combining the two. And so, as you know, as part of the movement here, San Onofre is in deep trouble on many levels. And so I said, well, that is great, because I was just trying to figure out how to bring the prayer aspect into the part of the movement down here that's been happening. And so it was perfect timing. And so we've been working together to bring them down. We'll be starting a peace walk from Dana Point Harbor, from the parking lot there, and then we'll walk the 10 miles to San Onofre.
This is going to be taking place on Friday, November 30th, starting at what time?
9 a.m. in the morning. So we'll hope people will gather between 8, 8:30, 8:45, and then we'll be ready to start the march by 9 o'clock, and then we'll walk out to San Onofre. We should arrive between 1 and 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
What if people aren't physically fit enough who want to participate but don't know that they can do the whole walk?
We're going to have a minimum of 3 cars available to pick people up whenever they want to stop. So we're going to leapfrog. We're going to have a car behind and a car ahead. If people need water, or if they need to, if they're done walking and they can't walk anymore, then that car will fall out and take a person back to their car. And then people can meet us later to end the walk if they choose to come.
That would be between 1 and 2 o'clock, and where would that be?
That will be just 1/2 mile south of the south exit of the San Onofre Nuclear Power Plant, just prior to the gate for the San Onofre campground. Along with participating at walk at any level that you choose, you'll also have the chance to participate during the fasting and the prayer event that will take place from around 7 a.m. to dusk every night between the 1st and the 7th of December. So whenever you want to come out and join at the protest site, at the prayer site, you will be able to do that for however long you want. We'll be singing, chanting, praying, and fasting for those. But you don't have to be fasting to participate in the event. You can come, participate for an hour, two, or three, or all day if you wish.
If you are interested in participating in the walk, the fast, the prayer vigil, would like to donate, or have any questions, you can contact Jean at the Rose office by calling 949-233-7724. That number will also be up at nuclearhotseat.com/blog. Finally, we hear from Ray Lutz, who is National Coordinator for Citizens Oversight Project and also holds a master's degree in engineering. Ray has been actively involved in the San Onofre issue since the steam generator problem showed up last January.
On November 30th, they're planning to have this meeting in the Dana Point area for a review of the request to restart Unit Number 2 at a partial power level. You know, they're required to have this meeting, but honestly, I don't think much is really going to happen other than they are just going to ask them some careful questions. To be perfectly honest, I don't think that Edison is really serious about this proposal. I think it's more to guard their stock price and make it look like there's a possibility they could restart this, because the chance of the NRC approving this thing with what's gone on so far, I think, is basically nil.
That's very interesting, because I got almost the exact opposite opinion from Gary Hedrick, who is also working with San Clemente Green on this issue.
Well, that's my opinion. I think that the technical issues are too severe for them to be able to turn this thing on. Now, I could be fooled. They do a lot behind the scenes, and I know that they've even had this thing in a hot startup mode for a while doing some experiments.
Right, that was about a month ago.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot would happen. Like, if they said, yes, we think you're right, go ahead and start this up.
In other words, if the NRC gave permission to Southern California Edison to restart San Onofre.
Yeah, they said, okay, we like your plan. First of all, that can't happen right away, because they have to first go through other hoops before they get to that point. But let's say it did. Let's say that they said, yeah, we really like your plan. Then there would be immediate lawsuits over this thing that I think would force it into a license amendment process. I don't think that it's conceivable that, number one, that they could actually approve it that fast, and number two, that even if they did, I think they'd be forced to go through these other hoops just because of the outcry that would occur. Nobody is just going to let this happen. And I think there's enough scrutiny on the NRC at this point on this issue that they're not going to just go for it that way. This meeting is just to hear what Southern California Edison is proposing and let the NRC ask some questions. There's no way that they can approve it at this meeting.
And how does the approval process take place? Are you familiar with that?
From what I can understand about it is that they are planning to have it go through at least probably another 6 months of review before they get to that point. And even if they get to that point and say, okay, we think this is a good idea, then automatically there's going to be people that step forward from all over that says, hey, running this thing at 70% is not actually mentioned in the operational license. And so you'll have to have that in there before you do it. Other licenses do say it. They have a line item in there that says, operate at this level. Here's how you do it. Because a lot of the things that they have to check are actually more critical when the plant is not running at full bore. When they're turning it down to a lower level of operation, there's a whole bunch of critical factors that come into play they have to check, and they can go into various accident modes at those lower levels more likely than when the thing is purring along kind of at steady state.
So in other words, even their plan is flawed because there are more dangers at running it at a lower level than running it at the full level. Did I get that right?
Not quite, because there is a different set of dangers. There's other things that come into play at these lower levels. And so if they're going to be running at a lower level on an extended basis, they're going to have a whole bunch of checks for the pressures and other surveillance items that they need to check on at those lower levels, because they have a whole bunch of surveillances that they do in terms of what's the pressure here, what's the temperature over there, and they have to check these different frequencies, say like once every 10 minutes, once every 2 hours, once every day. They have to check to make sure the whole thing is okay. And if you're at one operational mode, full power, you're going to have a certain set of temperatures and pressures that you're going to be checking and ranges that they're allowed in. When they say, we're going to run this at 70% power, other licenses that I've seen have a line item in there if they actually are planning to run at partial power, where they say, here's, you're approved to run at this power level, and here's a whole set of things that you need to be checking at that power level to make sure that the thing is safe. And if they don't go through that process of actually detailing out what all of these checks should be during that type of operation, then, that raises a big question about whether it's going to be safe to run it. Frankly speaking, I don't think that it's going to be any safer running at a lower power level.
So what would be the best possible outcome that you can foresee actually taking place as a result of this meeting on Friday?
My prediction is that what will happen is Southern California Edison will talk how safe it will be running at 70%. You're going to get questions from the NRC shooting back, hopefully very critical questions about their plan, and then that'll be it. And they'll go away, because nothing is really going to – I don't think this is a meeting where they're planning. Like, it's not on the agenda for them to make a decision that says, okay, go ahead. This is just a required meeting where they – publicly disclose what their plans are.
So it's not that this is the end of the line in terms of the hearings and there will be a decision forthcoming.
I don't think that, at this meeting, I'm predicting there's not going to be anything. It's just going to be, we're hearing what they say, and my view of it is there's no way this thing is ever going to restart. Okay, I think that their problems are so severe that they really honestly can't try to restart this. Now, that looks like they're going to, at least on paper, say they're going to try. And I think they're only doing that because they want to try to boost their stock to keep their stock prices from falling too much over this deal.
So will the public be allowed to speak this Friday? Will we all fit in a room that only seats 400 when the last time around SCE bussed in over 300 of their own union workers and forced them to stay in the room without even a pee break so they could cheer their own and boo us down? Will the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Regulatory Commission approve SCE's proposed restart plan, which is the height of nuclear numbnutsery? Or will common sense prevail, San Onofre be kept permanently shut down. SCE pay back ratepayers for the last 10 months of forking over our hard-earned money for a dead nuclear power plant and their shareholders' dividends? Come back for next week's Nuclear Hot Seat and hear all the latest developments. Here's today's final thought. The whole San Onofre situation keeps growing in public awareness as the lies and spin pile up. Apparently, Southern California Edison has carefully researched all the anti-nuclear talking points and are creating a dizzying level of spin in an attempt to keep people confused and thus easily manipulated towards supporting nuclear. Every step by SCE and its crony, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, seems intent on keeping our questions away from their need to answer and to leave falsehoods, half-truths, and semantic manipulation of information smack in front of citizens and reporters with no contradiction. Well, horse pucky. Concerned citizens in Southern California have been repeatedly telling the NRC that we want an adjudicated evidentiary hearing, a phrase that sounds like you need an advanced degree in jurisprudence just to grok what it means. So Nuclear Hot Seat is happy to translate. An adjudicated evidentiary hearing means put the nukes on trial. SCE, you think San Onofre is safe to restart? Great. Present your information under oath in a public forum and let our experts cross-examine your experts. Let us present our information, again under oath, and have your experts cross-examine ours. We have nothing to hide. We know what the truth is. We just want the chance to share it with the world. If nukes are so good and San Onofre is so safe, why are you afraid to let this kind of a hearing take place? Let's just pull a Perry Mason or a Law and Order, or for heaven's sakes, a Judge Judy. But let's put nukes on trial via San Onofre. Get all the information up and out where it can be examined, and only then make a decision while the whole world is watching. And hey, SCE, if you don't have the cojones for that, what the hell are you hiding? We think we know, but hey, we're willing to let the experts duke it out, as long as it's under oath, and we can watch via live stream, if not in person. So SCE, NRC, MOUSE, are you listening? Are you up for it? This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 27, 2012. Material for this podcast was gathered from ENENews.com, Fukushima Diary written by Iori Mochizuki, OPTV, Asahi, Yahoo News, the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook Network, and Reuters. You can find all our podcasts posted on nuclearhotseat.com/blog. That's right, all 76 of them. You can also find them on the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat pages and on iTunes podcasts, where you can subscribe for free. Share us, link to us, forward to your email list. Nuclear Hot Seat is the activist voice on nuclear issues, so use us as the resource we are. And if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, do not go back to sleep.